This is WBAI New York. The program is Mass Backwards, a weekly hodgepodge of noisy music, radio drama, and Gene Shepherd. And tonight's Gene Shepherd episode, which is going to begin immediately, with thanks to Bob Kay. It's one of the most requested programs. People want to know, yeah, I have that story about the camel. Well, by George, I do, and by George, that's what we're going to hear this morning from January 6th, 1971, a story we like to call The Camel and the Coat. Here's Gene Shepherd.
I love you. Oh, it's just that I'm in a contemplative mood. What's your mind? I'm in a naval investigating mood, and I'm not talking about ships. Yeah. By the way, that reminds me. Do you know what the definition of grubbles is? Have you ever heard the word grubbles? Well, that word was invented by a great American comic whom you don't hear about much anymore, but. He invented the word grubbles, and thousands of people realize what it is now, and millions don't even know. The word grubbles refers to the lint that one, over the period of, hurry, rush, everyday life, which is very rushed and pushed and very chock-a-block full of excitement today, that this is the lint that one gathers in one's navel. You know the lint that you gather? You mean you don't, Al? Of course you do. I'm sure you do. Any man worth his salt. Now, that's called the grubble, that little thing that you, the little lint. And he did something that I think is a beautiful example of man utilizing the things that are available to him. He finally, after saving for years, all throughout his adult life, he began actually when he was 10, saving the grubbles that he took out of his own little navel there. That at the end of maybe 30 years of saving, he had gotten together enough grubbles, which he kept very, very religiously, to stuff a beautiful heart-shaped pillow made out of velvet, you know, the red velvet on one side and the white beautiful, yes, of course, with yellow fringe. And on the outside, he simply had this single word inscribed in beautiful hem stitching, cross stitch with little crochet thrown in, mother. Of course, you got to know something about the biochemistry of the human being to realize the irony of what he was saying, friends. And tonight is a naval contemplation night. What I would like to suggest that all of you out there who don't like to even use the word, you tune on down the dial. You'll find something nice. I believe Julie Andrews is singing a potpourri, a selection of wonderful music from Sound of Music down the dial there, accompanied by, of all things, the Norman Luboff Choir. And there are other cultural events are occurring. I understand that even further on down the dial, a gentleman is being interviewed by another angry gentleman about the decline of boxing in the city of New York, is the way he puts it. And so you'll find a lot of things on that. In the meantime, you just let us do our little shticks and games. All of a sudden, people are starting to discover Edgar Kennedy. Listen, I think some of the greatest comedies ever made, you know, he'll never make it because he's not yet been picked up by the intellectual elite. But Edgar, do you know who Edgar Kennedy is? He's the guy, the famous movie guy with the slow burn, you know, the bald-headed guy. Used to put his hand over, you know, a fat guy. Don't you remember that? Slow burn Edgar Kennedy? Well, that shows how non-appreciated he is. You don't even remember him. And he has been appearing on Channel 5 lately. They're putting on these... I used to flip. I mean, every time I saw an Edgar Kennedy short, when they made two real comedy shorts, Kennedy used to absolutely knock me flat. And you know why? Because Kennedy's wife, and the way he wrote, you know, the way the comedies were put together, it was, well, it was the way it was. I mean, that's all I could say. Kennedy all right, I'll ask you a question. I mean, do any of you know, in his two real shorts that he made very famous, there were characters, one of them was called the brother-in-law. Another was called the wife. Another was called the mother-in-law. Now, Kennedy would come home in the beginning of every one of his of the two real comedies. A little fat guy, very. He looked like he was always on the verge of a heart attack. Yeah, he looked very dyspeptic, and he was always so good-hearted. He would always start out with the absolute best of intentions, and there would be a scene of him coming home from work, and he lived in this little house, and what did he do for a job? I wonder how many of you know that. What was his job? Well, I'll tell you so that it doesn't cause... He was a streetcar motorman. And he would come home from his job, and he'd walk into the house. And he'd always be very happy. You'd see him coming up the back steps, and he'd open the door, and he'd say, I'm home! Hey, I'm home! Hey, Eddie's home! And you look around the kitchen, you see a pile of dirty dishes in the kitchen with water dripping out of them. And you see the kitchen table there has still got the breakfast dishes on it. You see the little look of pain. And then out of the door would come his brother-in-law, still wearing his bathrobe. It's late in the afternoon after he's finished work, and his brother-in-law is mad. And he says to Ed, oh, you did it today. You really did it today. And Ed says, what did I do? You forgot to leave the keys to the car. And I wanted to go to the ball game. That's the way it started all the time. Ed was always... And I remember one scene when Ed's coming home real happy because he's telling the guys at work, see, he's got his new car. And he's delighted, see. He can hardly wait to get home from work because he's got this new car and he's going to take the car out and everything else. He's going to take the family out for a ride. And he's walking down the street and all of a sudden you see his car coming out backwards down the driveway. He's just backing out. He sees it. See, he's about a half a block away. He's just backing out, and there's nobody driving it. It just backs out, and it's like a Greek tragedy. It goes right across the street, and you see this truck come along. Boom! His brother-in-law done it again. He parked the car and left the brake on. Well, this is Edgar Kennedy, and one of the listener types writes in, he says, the Edgar Kennedy shorts that Channel 5 has been showing late at night are about the blackest comedy this side of Ionesco. In one of them, for instance, he hires a man who resembles him to impersonate him at home every evening so he can go out and play poker without his wife's knowledge. Yeah, that's right. This stuff was sinister. By the way, speaking of a black comedy here, you know, this life is a far blacker comedy, believe me, than any Ionesco could ever write. We have a little note here, for example. I'd like to salute Edgar Kennedy. I think he's, you know, he was great in his day. I'd like to, you know, speaking of black comedy, listen to this. I don't know whether I should bring this out to you on this, you know, this somewhat calm night. Now, why the heck? Where did I put... Here it is. I want you to listen to this headline. camel, dead in yard. Origin, unexplained. How's that for a nice little headline? Please, Herbert, please. Americus, Indiana. When Robert... Americus, Indiana. I'll bet none of you even... never heard of Americus, Indiana. I've been in Americus, Indiana. I'm from Indiana, you know. Americus, Indiana makes Flemington, New Jersey look like Manhattan. I'm serious. It's a little tiny town, Americus, Indiana. When Robert Bonnard's son came home from a basketball game at 1 a.m. and said, Dad, there's a camel in the front yard. Bonnard suspected his son had been hitting the jug. And he says, get to bed. And the kid went up to bed. The next morning, the family woke up, and there in the front yard was a camel dead. State police checked Indiana zoos for miles around and the remaining winter circus quarters at Peru, Indiana. No one to this reading has reported missing a camel, which was found dead on the lawn of the Bonnard House in Americus, Indiana. Dad, there's a dead camel in the yard. Ah, get up to bed, quit hitting that jug. All right. You reset that, Herb. We're going to need that. I want to tell you this. I want you to listen to me carefully, you clods out there. There is a strain of disbelief that runs through the average American mind because he's so used to fiction. The average American really believes the Paul Newman movies are true. That's the way life is. The average American who is so brought up on movies and TV shows and novels believes that they're far truer than real life. And so he does not believe the stories out of real life. I'm sure that a lot of you listening to this story about the camels are, oh, come on. Are you kidding? Camel, come on. Oh, and you believe Portnoy's complaint. You really do. Now, I should put it this way. The camel is a well-known phenomenon in Indiana. I have told the story many times about a camel. I'm going to tell it tonight for those of you who haven't heard it. It's a true story. But do you know what? That kid, Robert Bonnard's son, they don't even tell you what his name is. That kid, 40 years from now, is going to be sitting at a bar. He's going to tell the guys at the bar about the time he came home from school and there was a dead camel in the yard. The old man told him he was out of his bird and he'd been drinking. And everybody at the bar is going to say, oh, come on, Robert Bonnard's kid, don't give me that stuff. Yeah, you're full of canal water, Robert Bonnard's kid. You come around here, tell us all this jazz. Why? Because it's a story out of real life. And real life stories are far more difficult to accept than some contrived concoction of Edward Albee. We constantly refuse to believe the evidence of our own eyes, and especially our own ears. If I have told this story once, I've told it 20 times in the past. I'm going to tell it to you again for a reason. Like Robert Bonnard's kid, I too was the object of ridicule that was heaped on me in copious amounts and has been ever since because of an incident regarding a camel in the state of Indiana. Now, if some Lebanese had told you a story about a camel, you'd probably buy it. You agree with that? But if somebody from Americus, Indiana tells you a story about a camel, you are inclined to disbelieve. Why? Just the nature of the beast. For example, now I've been getting this lately. I've been getting letters from people who refuse to accept the fact, the absolute fact, Herb, that I am head thumping. When I play my head, I am thumping my head. I am not hitting a wood block. I am not playing upon a rubber band. I am actually head thumping. And a lot of people are furious because they try to do it and they can't do it. And so they conclude that nobody can do it, which is silly. I mean, that's like pretending that nobody can run a 4-minute mile because you can't. Obviously, a few people can. And it takes years of training. Dedication. Lifelong dedication. Now listen carefully to the sound of this head being thumped. That is the sound of a head being thumped, and I don't give a damn whether you believe it or not, friend. If you don't believe it, you're just missing 9/10 of life. That's the end of it. Right, Herb? It's actually happening. Now, if you'll give me a little music, Herb, a little of that razzmatazz music, I'll show you how the head is thumped in actual performance. Please, Herb. If you don't believe it, T.S. This is W.O.R. in New York.
Well, really, it's W.B.A.I. in New York. Don't you love substandard sound quality? Makes you listen that much harder. And before we continue, just to get a quick plug in here that Friday night, we will be back as part of the fundraising marathon here on W.B.A.I. 7 o'clock Friday. Herb, you will hear from Herb directly, Herb Squire. And Barry Farber, who were on a panel that I did about Gene Shepherd at last year's Friends of Old Time Radio convention. We will have that tape for you on Friday night. And some lovely FM broadcasts in perfect high fidelity, unlike this episode from January 6th, 1971. Friday night from 7 till at least 10, and I'm pushing for midnight. We may even hear parts of the NPR tribute and lots of other Shepherd memorabilia. So this Friday, 7 o'clock here on WBAI New York. And now back to this 1971 episode of Gene Shepherd.
May I do this once more, and then I'm going to drop it for a while. Because I'm preparing I'm working with a composer right now, Herb. I'm working with a composer on a sonata for head, bassoon, trumpet, and timpani. I'm serious. And we're gonna throw this at Lenny Bernstein, boy, I'll tell you. If he can throw a party for the Black Panthers, he can throw a party for a head spieler. Okay, now listen carefully. Listen to that head, boy. Fantastic sound. And it's not the sound of wood block being played either. Unless, of course, you want to be a cheap humor, you know. Of course, that's typical Jersey humor. Now, I'm a little concerned. You like that, don't you? I'm a little concerned, though, about this story to Campbell, because this guy, you know, Robert Bonner's son, 40 years from now, people are going to laugh and snort. And this could very well scar his psyche deeply. Do you notice one thing? The first thing, the old man didn't believe him. He didn't believe him at all. Did the old man go out and look to see whether there was a camel in the yard? No. They didn't find it out till the next morning, after the kid had been sent up to go to bed. Now, what did the kid learn about that? Well, I'll tell you what he learned. He learned the very thing that I learned when you're dealing with cooks. Nobody will believe anything you tell them about camels, for some reason or other. And I'm going to tell you a story, a true story about a camel, not in America's Indiana, but in a town very much like America's Indiana. Now, when I was a kid, we had, I was walking around being a kid, and you know, playing the thing right up to the hill, walking around wearing high tops, and reading Donald Duck and all that kind of stuff, and we're operating kids, and saying bad things about my old man, and standing behind a Sherwin-Williams paint sign with Schwartz and Flick and Brunner, and telling dirty stories, and we'd go down to Troop 41, and that was a Boy Scout troop I was in. I was in the Moose Patrol, and we'd go down to Troop 41, and every night we would have this slogan they'd give out. You remember when you had to give the Boy Scout salute, and then they had this Boy Scout Pledge of Allegiance, and you hold your finger like this. See, I'm doing it right now. See, you put your hand up and say, "I pledge allegiance." No, that wasn't what we said. I'm brave, clean, reverent, and I will always be truthful and honest and brave and all that stuff, and I will preserve the basic tenets of the Boy Scout religion, which is to be brave, clean, and reverent, and honest and truthful, and always be prepared. Well, I used to believe that stuff. Say, I was a kid, I thought, that's easy enough to do. It's always easy to be prepared. All you got to do is be prepared. You can keep your scout knife with you. And, there are actually people who believe you can't be prepared for life. Many people believe that. It's one of the great, sad misconceptions of existence, but they believe it. And if they want to believe that, I ain't going to be the one to rock their little old boat made out of a sugar cube, which is quietly and swiftly melting, even as they sit in the middle of it and holler, "I'm prepared." Well, all right. Sure, that's why the Titanic is such a classic story. I mean, all these people figured they had it made. And zap. That's very hard to explain to the first class passengers, your matched alligator luggage is now under 450 feet of water. It's not easy. But still, nevertheless, the mythology persists that people can be prepared for life. Well, I used to believe this. You see, when I was about 8 or 9, I figured, you can be prepared for life. How are you prepared? Why, you always keep your Boy Scout knife with you. That's one important thing. So if somebody leaps out of the bush, you can get them in the gizzard. Now, I don't know what you could... that was part of the mythology. You could be prepared by thinking ahead. That's what Miss Shields always say. Think ahead, boys and girls. Always consider ahead and plan your day in advance so that you do not waste time in bad planning. Well, that meant, hang in there. And the day before any kind of an exam, you were all supposed to pick up a book and read it. Well, at first I thought it was me. You see, I would always sit down and read the book the day before the exam, and I always come out with a 32 on it. And I always figured that I was reading the wrong parts, which is true. So even being prepared does not always work out. And so I'm how it is when you're a kid. You just walk around constantly looking, digging a scene, vaguely... uncomprehendingly looking at things. Well, in our neighborhood, we had this old house that was roughly built on the order of the old Charles Adams house. You know the old Charles Adams house in the Charles Adams cartoons? It was a gigantic Victorian pile of gray wood, and it had filigreed all over the outside of it. Tremendous house. And it must have been about 4 stories high, and it had bay windows. It had L's, those big things they have on the top, and had these big bold fronts and all of it. And on the top of it, they had one of these strange kind of fluted roof. And there were a couple of towers that stuck up that had these round kind of cone-like roofs on it made out of green tile. It's a wild-looking house, and it was set way back. I'd say probably a good 150, 200 yards back off the street. On this big, big lot, tremendous lot, that was overgrown with huge weeping willow trees. Tremendous place. And it was so completely out of context with the rest of the neighborhood that it just was sort of a mysterious place that nobody ever really seriously ever went near. And half the time it was boarded up, and the other half the time there were mysterious people living in it, and then they would go. And it was just completely not part of our world. However, there was an alley. And the alley used to wind around back of all the houses. And I was an alley type from the time I first started to get out and work in the world. Now, there are some people who have never stepped into an alley, except to very fastidiously take a bottle of Light and Lively, their little old crushed carton, and take it out and very fastidiously and drop it in the garbage can and hurry like hell back into the house. Well, there are other people who find the alley is the world. Now, it's very hard to know how you get that way. Did you ever read a book called The Circus of Dr. Lau, is it? Yes. Well, that's very much about the same thing. This writer, by the way, he wrote one book, really. He wrote several other books, but this is the only one that really makes it. The Circus of Dr. Lau. And it's about that world of the alley. Not really, but very, very tangentially. And so every day I would come home from school. I'm in third grade, roughly. Yes, in fact, it was third grade, but vividly. It was Miss Robinette. And I was in the Cub Scouts. And already I was studying, to become a full-fledged Boy Scout. You have to take the vows and all that stuff. And I was studying diligently. I had a copy of the Boy Scout handbook, which was, only bigger kids were in the Boy Scouts. And when you're in the Cub Scouts, you have one of these little hats with the little beanie bill. And I remember this purple hat, kind of dark blue hat. You remember those hats? With the little gold Cub Scout thing on the front with the gold piping on it. I had this beanie. And every night, after I would leave the Warren G. Harding School, I would set out down the alley. It was wintertime. Now, generally, in the summertime, I would not come home down through the alley because I wasn't going to the Warren G. Harding School in the summertime, obviously. We would be playing ball from the crack of dawn till the last kid was dragged out of the sticker patches trying to find a ball which had been lost for 4 weeks. And this was the summertime. But the wintertime, every night, it would be dark. It would be like maybe 3:45 or something like that. And the sky is getting gray. And I would set out down the alley with Schwartz and Fleck. And we would go down through the alley, and we would take opposite sides of the alley and look for stuff in the garbage as we come home. And we would find all kinds of wild stuff. Oh, yes, I never forget the time I brought home the purple toilet seat. And my mother flipped. And where'd you get that? I thought, found it. Let's put it on. She says, get that thing out of here. Well, that was a part of the education you learn when you're growing up. And so Schwartz was about halfway between school and my house. In other words, I was about twice the distance away from school that Schwartz was. He lived about halfway down. And so he would split off about halfway up the alley. Flick was between me and Schwartz. You got it? I was way out, where, like would be in the solar system in Jupiter. I was the furthest one from school. And so there would be a long part of the alley that I would traverse by myself. Now, when you're a private kid, you're very different than when you're with the guys. And so we would start out down the alley. It's about 3:45. It's cold and the wind is blowing. And we go plodding along the alley at the Schwartz and Flick. And I, we used to invent games, too. That was another thing. We'd have, for a very brief time, there would be a game. Like we would take a Pep milk can. I remember we used to play hockey in the alley. And we would constantly kick in his can, see? And the rules would constantly change, If you kicked it into Miss Snyder's garbage can, you got 2 points. So then there would be another game the next week. And we were continually, it was a continual moving procession of activity. Never static. And it was constantly changing the environment. And so during Christmas time, you would find all these little Christmas trees thrown out there, and thousands of miles of Christmas paper. And you'd find Christmas cards. And a lot of times, you'd even find an old Christmas present that somebody threw out. They couldn't figure out what the devil to do with this thing, so they finally threw it out. And we would find all kinds of stuff constantly. During Valentine's Day, you would find all kinds of Valentines out in the garbage. Everything reflected the holidays. You would find the Easter time, you'd find all kinds of Easter bunny stuff and all that. So we're always out there walking along. And back of this house, there was a huge garage. Now, it lay between Flick's house and my house, this enormous Victorian pile. Well, this garage had been, many years before, apparently, it had been some kind of a, I don't know what it was, some kind of a, maybe a servant's house or something, but it had a door in the back of it that faced onto the alley. It was not a garage door, but an actual door, like you could just go in, see? And the top half swung out. It was a swinging door, a split door. Well, one day, old chap is coming home. I've got on my brand new coat, which every winter was a big thing in the house, you know, to get the new coat. And I had this new sheepskin coat. Beautiful sheepskin coat. With a sheepskin collar. See, very groovy coat. And it came with a helmet that had goggles. It was made out of leatherette. You know how the leatherette stuff smells? Vague smell like rubber, sort of vaguely plastic. Well, every day I'm walking down past this garage, and I would look into the window. It was just a ritual. Because piled up in this window were all kinds of stuff. Now, in this house lived a famous magician. Believe it or not, we had a magician that claimed... I never saw him. Nobody ever actually saw this man. But he was a famous magician, and it was said that this was his winter headquarters, this house. And every couple of days, you'd see big trucks out in the back there, unloading stuff and that. And it really was an official house. Well, on this fantastic day, I'm coming home. And I look in the back window, and I see this face. Tremendous face looking out of this gray, dirty glass window, which was on the top part of the floor. This enormous face is looking out, and I'm looking in at him. It was the first camel I ever saw. There was a camel in the garage. Now, when you're 9 years old, how tall are you? Maybe 8, 9, 10 inches, maybe something like that. This camel was roughly the size of Lincoln Center. Unbelievable. I mean, I've been eating animal crackers for years. I've seen pictures of camels. But I never... This camel was so big. His head was like up at the top, the ceiling of the roof, up at the second story. Tremendous thing. And I see this camel. Well, something in my mind touched off a little bell. Don't tell nobody about it. Because I knew somehow that it was illegal to be back of the garage poking around looking at the camel. This famous magician named Mr. Thurston... Thurston the magician, Thurston the mysterious, had a camel in his garage. And this camel is looking out at me. He's got these strange, big, watery eyes and enormous nostrils. Head is moving back and forth. When I looked at him for about 5 seconds, he looked at me. Then his head moved forward, and he pushed the top, and the door swung open. He stuck his head out. And he's looking at me. I was scared out of my skull. But at the same time, I mean, I couldn't stop but look at him. I'm such a camel. Well, we stood there for about 3 minutes, me and the camel. I got a stick, see, and I've been running along. My usual practice was to run along after Flick split and run past all the various fences, and I had the stick, which I would, you know, along the fences. I used to particularly like to get Miss Snyder's rooster. It was about a half a block down. He'd flip every time I'd come. This rooster would run along. He was always trying to get me. Well, that was, you know, part of the whole scene. Now this camel, what a fantastic thing to find in your alley. Well, the next day, I don't tell nobody. The next day, Flick splits off, and I have saved a half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on whole wheat bread. Now, that was what I was... I was in my peanut butter and jelly bag at that time. I used to go through various phases of my lunches. I went through a salami phase. I always liked salami on white bread with the strawberry jelly on it. I went through that phase for a while. Then I went through my cream cheese phase with strawberry jelly. I love strawberry jelly. And I was now going through my peanut butter and strawberry jelly phase with whole wheat bread. Well, I have stuck a half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in my pocket. Well, for scientific experimentation purposes. And so I come along and I see this camel. He's looking at me. He's just head moving back and forth like a snake, you know. The head just moves back like a snake, back and forth. Well, I walk up to the door, and he looks down at me, and his head sort of ducks down, and I reach into my pocket, and I pull out the half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. When I hold it out, oh, he just sucks it up. He inhaled it. Oh, just like that big, wet tongue, big slummy. He's got big teeth. These teeth stuck on, I'll tell you, each tooth must have weighed 4 pounds, and they're yellow, you know. Boy, talk about, you know, the yellow going up. Man, I'll tell you, teeth. Ooh, you ever seen a camel's teeth? They're unbelievable. He just... This camel staggers back. I don't think he had ever had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich before. You know, camels usually eat the, you know, I don't know what camels eat, but it ain't peanut butter and jelly, especially Skippy Chunk-style peanut butter and jelly. He goes, his eyeballs, just flipped them. Ooh, he loved it, see? Well, I only had one half of a sandwich. You can see his head goes forward. He wants more. See, he's turned on. Well, I hang him around the camel for about 10 minutes this day, you know, and I'm poking him with a stick, and he's moving around. He wants more sandwiches, see? With that, I go back home to the house. Now, it was absolutely forbidden in our house to ever go near the Thurston house. Forbidden. Absolutely. In fact, every kid in the neighborhood was totally cut off of that scene. You weren't supposed to go near there, see? So I keep this in my head quiet. I don't say nothing. Well, the next day, another half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Well, I walk up to the camel this time, and he's waiting. See, he sees me coming down the street. He remembers the peanut butter and jelly. So I come along there, and I pull out the peanut butter and jelly. I'm about halfway up to him already. And I say, I hold it up like his eyeballs are spinning. So I walk up and he knocks that thing down. You could just see he was really hooked on peanut butter and jelly. He loved it. Now, if any of you ever have any occasion to have any dealings with a camel, I would suggest peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. That gets them right where they live. Now, I don't know why. I don't know. Maybe it's an old Arabic dish. I don't know. But they really turn on with this. Well, every day from that time on, it is cold. Winter. Cold. Wind is blowing. And it is gray. And now it is past Christmas time. And every day, I have this rendezvous with the camel. And every day, he is getting more hooked on peanut butter and jelly. And every day, I am bringing him a half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And every day, he is waiting for me. It got to the point where he would look out. I would see him. I would be about a block away, and I'd see his head looking out. And he could tell what time of the day it was, I guess, apparently, you know, by his stomach or something. He's looking out, and you'd see this big head like a snake just moving back and forth. And I would see him outlined against the gray skies, the skies of the smoke and the gray steam coming out of the steel mills. This camel in this bitter cold air waiting for his fix. Every day the peanut butter and jelly is coming. Me. And he loves me, see, I figure. Well, this goes on for maybe 6 weeks, and it's a deep-held secret. I know it's wrong, and I know that if my mother ever found out I'm feeding a camel peanut butter jelly sandwiches, forget it, because it would be hell to pay, you know. So, one day it happened. For some reason or other, I must say, it probably is my fault. I ate my entire peanut butter jelly sandwich. You know, you have these days when you're really hungry. I got nothing to give the camel. So I come down to, never realizing what is about to happen, see? And let this be a warning to all of you. If you ever get mixed up with camels, man, if you think elephants don't forget, and camels, oh, do they spit. Listen, that camel, sometimes when I would hold the sandwich out, a lot of times I wouldn't give it to him, by the way. The camel would go, boy, he could spit 30 yards. I mean, that camel one time hit me in the left lens of my goggles, my helmet and goggles. He got me in the lens of my goggles at about 45 yards. Oh, like a line drive. And is it smelly? He got spit like nobody's business. So I got to know all about camels, see, and my mother didn't even know I'd ever seen a camel. Once in a while, she'd say, you smell funny. Well, you know, you pick it up. And on this day, I'm walking down this alley with a stick. little realizing. See, I see the camel. His head is sticking out, moving back and forth like a snake. I walk up to him and I look him right in the eye. You know, the stick. I say, hi. He sniffs. His eyeballs are bugging. You can just see. He can taste it. You can just see the anticipation in his camel's eyes. You know, he's looking down and he starts sniffing down, see, towards my pocket, which he always did. I reach in my pocket and I have a old Wonder Bread wrapper, which I had around my sandwich, and I says, nothing here, Dad, and I throw it out. He rocks back. He ain't getting a peanut butter sandwich today. You could see this opaque look of profound disappointment. I'll always remember, Gorka, you have never seen the expressiveness in a camel's eyes, friends, unless you've dealt with one. This look of tremendous disappointment. I say, too bad, camel. I ain't got no peanut butter for you today, but we're all friends, right? And so I stick him with the stick, you know. He's looking bugged. I stick him with the stick again. With that, I say, so long, Dad. It's snowing. It's kind of cold out. And I've got my beautiful new coat on. I turn and start to go down the alley, and suddenly, whap! Something hits me from behind. I look behind, and I see this fantastic camel has got a hold of the back of my leatherette coat. Ah! Jump! He has taken a bite out of my leatherette coat. I'm serious, friends. The size of a basketball. They got big mouths. He just bit it right off, and he's chewing it. Oh. The camel swallows the big chunk of leatherette coat. He spits. And I go down the street scared. I go down the old alley scared to death. My leatherette coat. What am I going to tell my mother? I get in the house. I try to walk in sideways. And mother's, you know, instantly sense when you're faking it, you know. She's, what's the matter? Turn around. I turned around. She's, what happened to your coat? I says, a camel bit it. A what? A camel bit it off the back. Ooh, what did I tell you about lying? And 5 minutes later, I'm in the John with a bar of Lifebuoy soap sticking out of my mouth. And she says, now you tell me what happened to that coat.
The camel bit it.
If you don't stop lying, I'm going to tell your father. And you know what he's going to do? You know what he says about lying?
The camel bit it.
She says, now you tell me the truth. Well, I had to tell her the truth.
Cliff did it.
She says, what? Now, why did you tell me that in the first place?
Yeah, Cliff did it. He grabbed it. Tore it off.
And she gets on the phone. I hear her yelling at Mrs. Flick. Then I hear Mrs. Flick yelling at Flick. And then I can hear from the distance, Flick is getting it. And you know, that story has persisted to this day. Quite often when I talk to my mother on the phone, she says, do you remember the time you told that nutty story about the camel biting your coat? I say, yes, Ma, I remember. I learned one thing. People don't want the truth. Lie, kid. Lie for all you're worth, and they'll believe you.
How big an audience do you suppose you have? After all, the penalties for listening to a Freedom Radio station could hardly be more severe.
We must have a tremendous audience. We have a good wavelength, and our transmitter is strategically located. The people can't help hearing us, even if they are forbidden to hear us.
Aren't you afraid that you'll be caught?
Not anymore. I think that if we were located, somebody would let us know there was danger. We have many friends.
I know. That's how I was able to locate you and offer you my services. But supposing they do find you, what could you do?
I could die, of course. But there are other transmitters like this one. There will always be more and more of them.
Sometimes, as you work here, it must seem futile. The air is so crowded with voices and the punishment for listening is so decisive.
No, I never feel discouraged. I believe that any station broadcasting lies will lose its audience in the long run to the stations that broadcast the truth.
Yes, a tribute to WBAI. Give them lies, kid. They can't handle the truth. Gene Shepherd, from January 6, 1971, and a little fraction of a fragment of a program we played on the Golden Age of Radio last night called Free Speech. And by George, in the last 4 minutes of our broadcast time this morning, I want to give you an opportunity to support WBAI. That's right. We saved the fundraising for the end of the program, and we've got a couple of minutes, and we actually may have a few bodies, a few able bodies around to answer your phone calls if you are so inclined to support this radio station. And, yes, three times a year, WBAI comes onto the airwaves and asks our listeners who appreciate our programming to pay for it, because we have no commercials, we have no sponsors other than the listeners. And that being said, the annual membership rate of WBAI is $50 a year, $25 the poor people's rate. And during this Mass Backwards program, we offer a Gene Shepherd premium. Now, unlike that show we just heard, which was recorded from AM radio in 1971, the programs we're offering as part of the premium package are actually from master recordings that were sent out for syndication around 1965. That you get four of those for a $75 pledge to WBAI if you would like to become a member and take advantage of that offer that is available this morning. Four of the syndicated shows from 1965 for a $75 pledge to WBAI. You can charge it on Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or we will send you a bill. But we need to hear from our listeners who appreciate the sort of programming that we bring you. And we ask you now to go to the phone. Pick up the phone. That's for you late-night TV viewers. I love cheesy television. Pick up the phone and dial 212-209-2950 and support WBAI. So I am going to thank those of you who have called this morning, urge you to tune in Friday at 7 for the real Gene Shepherd special, and or Sunday night at 7:30 for the Golden Age of Radio, and or next Monday night at midnight for Joy Works with Carlotta Joy Walker. But I'll let her tell you about that herself, because she will be coming along any second now, right here at listener-sponsored WBAI New York.